You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from London and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, defence correspondent Robert Fox and diplomatic commentator John Everard are here in the studio to review the day's top news stories from Syria to North Korea. And London's Sky Cycle is unveiled. Hugh Thomas, partner of Foster & Partners, tells us how it could revolutionise the daily cycle. Then...
Life is absolute perfection, as is true of my complexion. Every time I look and see me, I'm reminded life is dreamy.
Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International New York Times, is here to talk through the theatrical winners and losers of the holiday season. All that, plus we'll catch up with our man in Belgrade and play a bit of music too. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest headlines.
Iraq's prime minister says he will order an all-out assault on the city of Fallujah unless its people force out the militants who have seized control. Groups linked to al-Qaeda took over Fallujah and parts of nearby Ramadi last week. Hundreds of civilians have fled, but Nouri Maliki says they must force the insurgents to leave. Abdul Bari Atwan is the editor of the Al-Quds Al-Arabi newspaper, which is based in London.
Tribal forces there will try to do the job, but it will be a bloody one. I don't believe it is easy to root out al-Qaeda and its affiliates completely from that part of the world. There will be a lot of bargaining between the tribal chiefs and the government. If you want us to do the job, you have to recognize us, you have to listen to us.
South Sudan's president says he won't agree to any preconditions set by rebels. Both sides have met for the first direct peace talks in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Salva Kiir, meanwhile, met his Sudanese counterpart, who agreed to look at setting up a joint force to protect oil fields from the conflict. Bangladesh's prime minister is dismissing claims that elections in the country on Sunday had no legitimacy. Sheikh Hasina's Awami League won two-thirds of the seats in parliament, but the main opposition party boycotted the vote, meaning more than half the seats were uncontested. Just one in five voters took part, but Mrs. Hasina says her critics are wrong.
It doesn't mean that there will be a question of legitimacy or anything, no. People participated in the poll and other political parties, they participated.
Romania's former prime minister has been jailed for 4 years for taking bribes. Adrian Năstase was given another three-year sentence for blackmail, and his wife got a three-year suspended sentence for collusion. Mr. Năstase tried to take his own life 2 years ago after he was given another prison sentence in a separate case. The health of the former Israeli prime minister Ariel Sharon is continuing to deteriorate. Doctors warned last week of a significant risk to his life. Mr. Sharon has been in a coma since a stroke in 2006. Ziv Rothstein is the director of the Sheba Medical Center, where Mr. Sharon's being treated.
Still, we define his situation as critical with immediate danger to his life. There is no significant change in his basic condition. In one hand, there is still stability of his cardiovascular system. On the other hand, we see the slowly deterioration of the function of his other organs.
Large parts of the US and Canada are struggling with bitterly cold conditions. Forecasters blame a polar vortex for the winter storm, which has seen temperatures fall below minus 30 degrees Celsius in places. More than 3,000 flights have been cancelled so far today. Schools in many US states have closed, and people have been told to stay indoors. Thousands of people gathered earlier in the Portuguese capital Lisbon to pay tribute to one of the world's greatest footballers. Eusebio died on Sunday at the age of 71. Portugal has declared 3 days of national mourning for the country's first footballing superstar. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18.05, which means it's 13.05 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the day's news here in the studio is Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, amongst many other places. Well, welcome both to the programme, and Happy New Year. We're going to start today in the Middle East, where US Secretary of State John Kerry has been once again shuttling for 4 days between various capitals and various leaders as he attempts to find a peace deal in the region. He made a surprise visit also to see the Jordanians and the Saudi royals to try and get their support. Let's start with you, John. It's been an amazing kind of shuttle again. It's his 10th visit to the region. He seems a man who's an eternal optimist. Do you think he has anything to be optimistic about?
Well, yes, he's a man, eternal optimist, I don't know, certainly a man full of energy and a man who's quite clearly determined to leave a lasting monument to his tenure as Secretary of State. Something to be optimistic about? It's very, very hard to say because so little information has been released. And we've had all the usual atmospherics. The Israelis and the Palestinians have hurled abuse at each other, which, you know, it'd be strange if they didn't. That's kind of the way things are over there. And he's clearly done quite a lot of rallying of other regional powers. It's not at all clear whether he's anywhere near a deal. He said himself that you shouldn't expect a deal this time round. This is part of a process, and he's expected back in the region really quite soon. So I think we'll see a number of these trips. Is it going to come to anything in the end? We can but hope.
Robert, you know, for the Israelis, I often wonder what's in it for them at this point. You know, there's kind of mayhem going around them in the Middle East. Everyone's slightly distracted by events across the border from them. They're kind of getting on with their own business in many ways. They've got the territory they want. You know, I see that some of the discussion is potentially that they will stop building more settlements on the West Bank, but they don't want any rush into talks. They're talking about, you know, 2015. For the Israelis, is there anything really to secure in, you know, going along with an American deal?
I think they'll go on with the talking, and they will go on with talks about talks. And as you say, that as John was saying quite rightly, we've had the ritual hurling of abuse of leaders of the two delegations. That's absolutely par for the course. And then little bits of carrots dangled that they might allow a bit of partial return for some of the refugees. But this really addresses your question because it isn't on the main effort. I think even Kerry must realise this. The preoccupation is now so much with what is going on to the north, and particularly at the moment. I know the spotlight shifts and juggles all the time, but we now have a major problem in Lebanon because this very, very nasty communal conflict, however you care to describe it, in Syria is really spreading there because we have seen AQ elements, Al-Qaeda elements, having a go at Hezbollah and vice versa with the murder of one of Rafik Hariri and then his son Saad Hariri's closest confidant, Mohammed Shatta. It's bad days are here again, but history never repeats itself. And I won't even use the cheesy cliche of Mark Twain that it merely rhymes. But we're going into another cycle. And one of the uglier aspects, be very interested to hear what John has to say about this, is how feisty the Russians are becoming about this. They have been saying some very tough things indeed to the Saudis. And the Saudis have come back. They've offered the regime forces, I mustn't call them Lebanon forces because they're something different, $3 billion allegedly for defense funding. It's a very close to proxy fight with Hezbollah and Iran. And yet we're going to be talking, I know, about possible talks about Syria. And there's some discussion about whether Iran gets involved in that in 2 weeks' time in Geneva. Not likely as long as the Saudis have anything to do with it.
John?
Yeah, I think Russia, I think the way that Russia is behaving tells us a lot more about Russia than it does about the Middle East.
Agreed.
Russia is on a roll. I mean, we've got the Sochi Games coming up. Putin is still basking in what he sees as his great success over Syria. Remember the chemical weapons. So I'm not sure that, you know, that there's so much of a geopolitical slant to this. A lot of this just reflects the way that Putin sees the world.
But do you think Russia will begin to get its way a little bit more, even with the Americans and their discussions with the Israelis?
Don't know. No sign of that yet. It's something to watch for. I wanted to say also, you're quite right to point to the problems up north. I think the developments to the east are also playing a big role.
Agreed entirely.
That you know, for the first time, Bibi Netanyahu always used to be able to sit pretty, knowing that he was America's key ally in the region, and that he was needed because America needed to balance off antagonism with Iran. He's no longer got that certainty. Nobody quite knows where the detente process with Iran is going to go, but the Israelis have already made clear that they are deeply uncomfortable with what is happening, and it will affect their stance in the current negotiations.
Can I say two things, but very interesting points that John has raised. It is very interesting through the usual or unusual channels in the UK how the Israelis have been putting out the message about the temporary deal on enrichment with Iran. This is, in Israeli eyes, a temporary deal, and it's one that they expect to go to setback. And what are you going to do then? They are very, very concerned, and I think quite legitimately from their perspective, that this becomes a permanent deal as it stands. It's got to go further than the arrangements that we have over enrichment and the plutonium plant and so on. And we won't go into the details for the moment. There's another observation that I would like to make. I follow John's reasoning entirely about Russia, but there's something that we've missed, and I must say I reproach myself for this. I was talking to one of our very senior service chiefs. He's a chief of staff, and it was a private conversation this morning. But he was turning my attention to how much of a military renaissance there is that's going on under Tsar Putin, as he put it. We are missing that. Probably we're missing it because it is not aimed at NATO. It is not aimed at Europe or Western Europe particularly at all. But he is bulking up his muscle because he is following the adage, you know, if you want to have influence, you must have a capability of projecting power. And it's something that we must watch. It's a big thing, but it's not aimed in this area. It is from, as John has put it, east of Israel and further east, and in the area in which he particularly has expertise. But it's a renewed factor again.
And just before we move on then, you said you don't know what his ambitions are in Israel, but it does make it seem less likely then that the Americans could pull off any kind of peace deal in the region without, in the future, kind of asking Moscow what they feel as well, especially if we are seeing the influence of Moscow in Saudi Arabia, in Lebanon, and we know of its influence, obviously, within Syria.
I think the Americans would want, in any case, to have the Russians on board for any peace deal. Russia, not the strongest player in the region, but still capable of making real mischief if its nose is put out of joint. What we don't know is how difficult that would be. And we don't know that because we really don't know exactly what it is that Russia wants out of this whole situation.
Well, let's just open the discussion. And there has been talk at the weekend. There was a very interesting report, for example, in the New York Times, which seemed to have good inside track on this, that the Americans are wondering the role that Iran would play in any peace negotiations over Syria. And there seems to be some caution on the American side and on the French side that unless Iran agrees, that the outcome of talks could be the removal of Bashar al-Assad and a government that would pave the way to a more kind of a broader group of people in power, that they may not let the Iranians get involved. But again, John, really, whether the Americans decide to let the Iranians get involved or not, they are involved, and it surely is better to have them at the table than pulling strings in the background.
Yes, it is. I'm sure that's part of the American calculation. It's also intriguing that they've effectively gone public on the requirement for Iran to accept that the outcome of a transitional exit, a transitional sort of power structure, rather, while Assad exits, as the price, as it were, for coming to the table. I can't imagine that they would have said this in public without some confidence that the Iranians would take such a proposition seriously. Now, if there's any fundament to that, then Assad must be getting very, very nervous by now. I mean, if Iran is prepared to play along with a strategy that leads to his eventual departure, Assad's circle of friends has dropped rather sharply.
Robert, do you think that there's a kind of potentially a bit of a nice way for everybody, all the other powers, to get out of trouble here? Because in a way, the West now surely doesn't want to see a complete overthrowing of the Ba'ath Party and all of its mechanisms, because it's seeing the chaos around it. So they'd be quite happy if there was a kind of a nominal getting rid of Mr. Assad. And the Russians, they would still have their kind of their port and their kind of their influence. The Iranians would be kind of happy. Do you think that actually Mr. Assad may be the pawn that has to be given up for everyone to be happy?
I think I have to say that the track record of Paris, Washington and London at finessing these things in that part of the world has not been terribly good. And the fact is that particularly Washington and London are tainted by the experience of Iraq, so it's going to be very, very difficult for them to do it. I agree with John. I think probably Iran, because they've got a really big goal, which isn't entirely predicated on Syria and their support through Hezbollah of the Assad regime. They've got a much bigger goal in mind, and that's just a breakout of its own sense of isolation. And that is quite clearly what Zarif and Rouhani are about. Funnily enough, I think it's Russia that's going to be most difficult about the removal of Assad. I was talking to a Russian friend, and he's one of these sort of really secular-minded analysts, and he was saying the odd thing about Russian foreign policy towards Syria and the Syrian regime is that there's not much new in it. There's a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the support could almost be the kind of stuff that I grew up when I was first entering journalism in that part of the world, from the Cold War era. I think it's going to be very difficult. What I fear about these talks, it's going to be a jolly good forum to meet and exchange, particularly if the Iranians are there, and that will be important. But I see the shades of Vietnam in this. The talks on Vietnam started in Paris in 1968, and the thing ended when the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, entered Saigon in 1975. I think that they could talk and talk and talk. I think things are so entrenched. But purely from a military perspective, and I think we haven't paid enough attention to this, I think we have not been paying enough attention to where Assad is. Yes, certain amount of arms, but it's technical stuff, and it's quality rather than quantity that's been going in from Russia. With the amount of firepower that's going down, they must be using up a hell of a lot of their kit, particularly if they're using tracked vehicles, fighter aircraft, which we know they're doing. The fact that they were using barrel bombs, that's just drums of stuff, in Aleppo, that's actually a measure of desperation. They're running out of it.
And we also saw when they were trying to get out the chemical weapons, they couldn't really secure the route to the port. So first of all, you felt that there was something, perhaps it was just under attack, but then you realised they really didn't have the power to kind of get those chemical weapons. I think you want to make one final comment, John, before we move on.
I was agreeing entirely with Bob. I think this is indeed an aspect we have neglected, that the munitions are being drawn down very fast. Assad is getting nervous. I've just said on the diplomatic front, on the military front also, he's having a very rough ride. One aspect of all this that we all take for granted is, does Assad actually want to stay now? Or would there be circumstances in which Assad, given a luxurious retirement somewhere safe, might say, thank you, that's enough, and just go?
That's where the Moscow apartment comes back in again. Maybe the Russians again.
Maybe.
It might be on the Bosphorus.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and John Everard. We'll return in a minute with stories from Asia. Stay tuned.
In 2014, the Foreign Desk is coming to Monocle 24. Interviews with presidents and prime ministers, reports from the front line, the debates, the arguments, the analysis on the world's most important stories.
There are two conventional wisdoms in Europe at the moment. The first is that the far right will dominate and be very successful at the European elections, and the second is that the far right is on the rise across Europe generally. We need to correct those two assumptions.
My hope would be that the new government in China feels sufficiently secure next year that they can ease up a little bit on the rather worrisome repressive tendencies.
Every Saturday at 12 noon in London and available for download all week on Monocle.com, iTunes and SoundCloud.
This is a challenge to give them the knowledge, to give them the hope for the future that they could reintegrate into society, believe that they can get a job, get them to decouple from criminal activities, and we have more to do when it comes to these matters.
I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is The Foreign Desk. Join us from Saturday, the 11th of January.
Over the past year, Monocle has sent its correspondents across dozens of countries on a giddying array of planes, trains, and automobiles to gather up the very best in cabins, concourses, suites, and tables. And we've edited these together in a photographic slideshow for you to watch at your leisure.
Japan's southerly island prefecture has everything a tropical paradise should have. White beaches, clear waters, balmy weather, and a slow pace of life. One thing that has been in short supply is high-end hospitality. The Ritz-Carlton has done its bit by opening its luxury Okinawa outpost in the Kiza Country Club.
Monocle's latest travel top 50, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. This is Andrew Tuck. It's currently 18:21 here in London, and you're listening to Monocle 24. Still with me is Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, where we're going to quickly turn our attention before we head on to Japan. There's been a story running through the papers at the weekend that supposedly Kim Jong-un's uncle had been killed by being thrown to the dogs.
Woof, woof.
It now turns out this is a kind of a made-up story, John.
Well, we don't know. The sole source of the story is Wen Weibo, a pro-Chinese Hong Kong paper, which didn't quote its sources, and nobody has got any collateral at all for it. In North Korea, anything is possible, but I think we look for something a bit firmer than that before we start to take it entirely seriously.
So how does a story like this just literally, it was in all of the serious papers at the weekend, reported as fact? Does it make you kind of like wince when you see these?
It does. I mean, a single source, not very well-sourced story, repeated without any kind of critical comment by papers for whom I got high respect. That was a bit disappointing.
And just before we open the discussion to Japan, just tell me, Dennis Rodman, is he just the useful idiot?
Yes, perhaps not even that. I mean, Dennis Rodman has said repeatedly that he doesn't do politics. This is all about sport. And he's been criticised, as you know, for going, despite the human rights abuses of North Korea. Useful idiot? Maybe, who knows, a match might do some good. Whatever. I mean, the expectations that Dennis Rodman was going to say anything useful or critical to Kim Jong-un clearly have not come about. And I think anybody who hoped that this was an opening for US-North Korea relations will be sadly disappointed. I see, incidentally, that his backer has now withdrawn. Paddy Power no longer supports him.
Okay. can I ask you about Kim Jong-un's pathology? It is very interesting, as somebody who doesn't know that part of the world, to read of his New Year's message, very much imitating, is it his grandfather, the founder, leader?
That's right.
What is he up to?
He is trying to rally his country. He's been through a very rough patch, after all. You're seeing somebody as powerful as Jang Song-taek executed will have sent shockwaves right through North Korean society. So the key point of the New Year's message was normality, progress, a lot of stress on economic development, and a half a hand outstretched to South Korea. Why? This isn't the lovely cuddly stuff. This is because he knows very well that the tap of money from China is slowly being turned off. And he needs money from somewhere. So the obvious place to get it is from the South. Interesting that the South has already responded, saying effectively, if you are serious about this, then let's have this reunion of families separated by the war that we planned last year and which you called off. That, I think, will be a litmus test and one to watch.
I'm not sure what the idea of returning to normality is for North Korea.
Well, yes. These things are relative.
But let's head to Japan, where the diplomatic row between China and Japan took a turn for the worse when the Japanese leader Shinzo Abe on the 26th of December visited Tokyo's controversial Yasukuni Shrine, where several people accused of war crimes are interred. Now, he says
accused
it was,
of 14 unconvicted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he says it was a private visit and nobody's business. Now, it must have been one of the worst diplomatic moves possible, surely, Robert, because here the Japan had managed to garner quite a lot of sympathy over the disputes over the islands between China and Japan. The West was certainly on its side, but when he does something like this, it just changes the narrative and blurs all the kind of rights and wrongs and just puts China in such a kind of a strong moral position.
Again, the question is why? What did he think he was doing? And there's been much intelligent speculation by people who really do know the region, and just know John's take on this, that was he trying to divert attention by ramping up the rhetoric and the subliminal battle of wills with China because he is so concerned about the performance or the non-performance of crucial aspects of the Japanese economy? But where is Japan moving itself geopolitically? Because there was another piece in which brought an excoriating, very well argued leader from the New York Times about them lifting restrictions on defense exports. Oh, but don't other people make big defense export stuff? Japan, in terms of the really high-end, high-tech switching gear, that kind of thing, I should think half the really sophisticated British stuff has Japanese or Japanese clones or copies in it. This is a very, very significant move. That this really was a change since 1945, that they had lifted restrictions on what are deemed to be absolutely core defence. They're not dual use, they're defense-aided products, and they will be much in demand. So what are they trying to do? I mean, it is thumbing your nose at China. Where this goes, I simply haven't a clue. And I think that a lot of people in the States are extremely worried about this, about where this, the dispute over the islands and the provocation over the shrine, where is it taking us?
And John, you're reading.
Yes, I mean, I don't think we need to speculate. The Americans have made clear that they're worried and said so in words of one syllable. Why did he do it? I think there's a mishmash of reasons. Firstly, there is snubbing in your nose at China, certainly. Furious at the way that the Chinese have behaved over the Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands, and particularly the Addis, the air identification zone, which of course overlaps with Japan's. Abe is known to be personally very angry about that. Also, he's under a lot of domestic pressure. His own right wing have been urging him to do this. And it's important to remember that on the last festive occasion, where it was sort of expected that he might go to the shrine, he didn't go himself. He sent a representative in a private capacity, which must have been quite difficult for him. Did China, or for that matter Korea, give him any credit for this? Not a bit of it. I suspect that this time round, part of it is that Abe thinks he might as well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb. If he's not going to get any credit with his neighbours by sending a representative rather than going himself, then why not go the whole hog and please your right wing?
But he's alienating more and more people, isn't he? Because, the South Koreans are upset about it. You know, in the past, he seemed to be doing quite well at kind of aligning a kind of new generation of Southeast Asian nations, Vietnam, and using diplomacy of trains and aid to kind of win friends. But this move doesn't seem to be a wise one.
Yes, from our perspective, not. I think there's something else going on, too. I think that they're very worried about Obama and the Obama doctrine of the pivot, because the pivot hasn't worked. You remember the idea was that they were going to pivot to Southeast Asia. We weren't going to be so concentrated. And boy, have we got problems in the Gulf. That that David Gardner was pointing out, the foreign affairs analyst in the Financial Times, is the pivot, it's only half a pivot. And I think there's something that's coming up from Southeast Asia saying that half a pivot is not better than none from Obama, and particularly with the kind of kit that you need to project a game to support a pivot, carrier groups and so on and so forth, they're cutting back on them.
Well, yes, I mean, the Japanese have made very clear their concern about the way this will be implemented. The irritated people, yes. I think there's an element of Japanese exasperation. It's not just the Chinese that they're annoyed with, but the Koreans also, in Japanese eyes, have behaved like infants. You know, there were Korean courts questioning the 1965 settlement of claims for the convict women and the slave labor. President Park of Korea virtually refusing to talk to Prime Minister Abe. You know, this hasn't gone down very well in Tokyo.
Well, gentlemen, we are going to have to leave it there. We're going to have our own little pivot, actually, to allow Paul Osborne to come in for the news. But Robert Fox and John Everard, thank you very much, as always, for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Belgrade, hear a sky-high cycling proposal for London, and we'll review the latest theatre highs and lows with Matt Wolfe. But before we get started on that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
Iraq's prime minister has said he will order an all-out assault on the city of Fallujah within days unless its people force out the militants who have seized control. Groups linked to al-Qaeda took over Fallujah and parts of Ramadi last week. Hundreds of civilians have fled, but Nouri Maliki used a televised address to say they must force the insurgents to leave instead. The president of South Sudan has said he won't agree to any preconditions set by rebels. Both sides have met for the first direct peace talks in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. Meanwhile, Salva Kiir met his Sudanese counterpart. The two men agreed they would examine whether to set up a joint force to protect oil fields from the conflict. The Prime Minister of Bangladesh has dismissed claims that the elections in her country on Sunday were illegitimate. Sheikh Hasina's Awami League won 2/3 of the seats in Parliament, but the main opposition party didn't take part. It meant more than half the seats were uncontested, and the turnout was just 1 in 5 voters. Romania's former prime minister has been jailed for 4 years for taking bribes. Adrian Năstase was given another 3-year sentence for blackmail. His wife got a 3-year suspended sentence for collusion. And large parts of the United States and Canada are struggling with bitterly cold conditions, with temperatures below minus 30 degrees Celsius in places. More than 3,000 flights have been cancelled so far today, and in many cities people have been told to stay indoors. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 18.32 here in London, which means it's 21.32 in Moscow and 14.32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Belgrade, where Monocle correspondent Guy Delaunay is ready to take us through some of the top stories from his turf. Guy, happy Christmas. Yes.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. Merry Christmas to you too.
And we should explain why we're saying this, because actually, it's Christmas Eve in Serbia.
It certainly is, which has lent Belgrade a somewhat interesting atmosphere. I've just walked down Knez Mihailova, which is the main pedestrian street in Belgrade, about a kilometre long, and it's normally absolutely packed with people at 7:30 in the evening. Buskers, vendors, street food, everything you'd expect. People going up and down on a nice little early evening promenade. Tonight, Very few people indeed, and that's all because it is Orthodox Christmas here in Serbia, an event which is taken very seriously indeed.
And tell me, in this globalised world, has the significance of the day been worn down over recent years? Do people also celebrate the kind of more Western-dated Christmas, or is it kind of this the special time of year?
Yeah, funnily enough, 25th of December is a school day in Serbia, so good luck celebrating then if you really want to. But they want to keep hold of these traditions if they possibly can in Serbia, because it's a key part of the Serb identity, is being Orthodox. It's what sets them apart from neighbours like the Croats. The Croats are basically, if you want to go down into the DNA, not very different from Serbs at all, but it's the religion and the worship and the various festivals that they observe that makes the two particularly different, Serbs being Orthodox and the Croats being Catholic. And so, of course, Orthodox Christmas is a very good chance for people to say, yep, this is, we are Serbs, this is who we are, and this is how we celebrate. So this evening they'll be having celebratory dinners with their families, who probably a lot of them in the countryside. This is why Belgrade is so quiet. And then tomorrow is the big day, really, because not only is it Christmas Day, but it's the end of 40 days of fasting, which is as miserable as it sounds, to be honest with you. So many poor old roast suckling pigs will be meeting their ends over the next 24 hours.
Well, if I'd known, one, you had no food, and two, you weren't celebrating Christmas over the last few weeks, I might have had a few shifts for you here in London. Now, tell me, I understand one of the, there's a few good, kind of good traditions at this time, and one of them is burning the Yule log. I presume you don't have a chocolate Yule log in Serbia, then?
No. It's an absolute real wooden one. And ideally, what the father of the house, the patriarch of the house, would go into the woods, presumably with his eldest son, usually, because this is a key part of becoming a man and all that sort of thing. And they would pick out a fine branch of a tree and they would chop it off, and that would be the Yule log, which traditionally gets burnt at 8 o'clock on a Christmas Eve. These days, people cheat, I'm afraid to say, Andrew. I was outside one of the supermarkets earlier on, and there were vendors selling Yule logs. And now I know we're in Belgrade, but this just, you can surely do better than that, can't you?
And it was interesting. One of our Spanish member of staff served a cake today, which is served traditionally on the 6th, which was, I think, the Epiphany cake. And it's got things hidden in it that you're meant to find. But you have a similar tradition with Christmas bread as well.
That's right, Christmas bread. At any of these sort of saints feasts that you have in Serbia, you're served by the priest the big round bread, In a very formal way, and everybody has to take a piece to partake of the communion. And the trick with the Christmas bread is it has coins hidden in it. So, you know, dentists probably also very happy at this time of year.
So are you going to tucking in again tomorrow after having a kind of a British Christmas as well?
Absolutely not. I'm bursting out of my out of my trousers as it is already. Thank you very much.
Now, on this slightly more serious topic, which is Serbia's neighbours in Croatia, they're having a referendum on whether they should ban the Cyrillic script. Is that correct?
Well, it's not quite confirmed yet, this referendum. However, people are making serious noises about it. Now, as we mentioned, there are some cultural differences, important cultural differences between the Serbs and the Croats, even though they speak the same language, even though they're very much the same people, really, but they like to think of themselves as completely different. And one of the ways in which they divide themselves is the Serbs generally use Cyrillic script, and the Croats generally use Roman script. And this has caused some controversy in parts of Croatia, where the signs are in effect written in both scripts, in much the same way as you'd get signs written in Welsh and English in Wales. You've got them written in Cyrillic and Roman alphabets in Vukovar, which is part of Croatia that was very well known because of the conflict in the 1990s. Now, there's still a very large ethnic Serb population in Vukovar, more than a third. So by law, the signs have to be bilingual. But a lot of Croat nationalists are very unhappy about this, and they're campaigning for a referendum to ban Cyrillic signage.
And what's the likelihood of that being passed, do you think?
It's higher than it was, because at the end of last year, we had this referendum on same-sex marriage in Croatia, which was brought about because a conservative Catholic group campaigned for it. 700,000 signatures were added to a petition. And when you've got 700,000 signatures on a petition of a country of 4.5 million people, you know pretty much you're going to win. And so same-sex marriage was, in effect, constitutionally banned in Croatia at the end of last year. Now, a lot of people at that time panicked because they realized if you can do this with that single issue, you can do it with a lot of other single issues. And to my knowledge, the government of Croatia has been working on ways of restricting these referenda, but it isn't there yet.
Now, let's move on to a bit of a kind of a hero story. And this is the story of Nikola Tesla, one of Serbia's kind of greatest sons. Now, there are plans to honour him, I believe, in the US.
Absolutely. And I wanted to bring this up because it is Tesla's, the anniversary of his death.
Should we tell people what did he do? Do you know what he actually did? Because I have looked up and I'm not being the most clever bod in the science class. He patented the AC induction motor. Yeah. How about that?
I mean, this is it. He was one of the fathers of alternating current, which is a very big deal because that's something that we use every day. He was also one of the fathers of radio, who many people believed he didn't get the correct credit for.
Thank you, Mr. Tesla.
And he was doing things which seemed very ahead of their time, like wireless electricity transmission. You know, and people think they're being fairly swish if they've got a wireless phone charger these days. Well, Tesla had the idea of transmitting electricity from an enormous transmission tower in New York State and beaming it wirelessly. What could possibly go wrong with that? But that was his big idea. And he got a lot of publicity at the time, fell into obscurity for many years. But in the past decade or two, as evidenced by the fact that you've got the Tesla car now, very trendy and hip electric vehicle, he has become something of a cult hero once more. And in the United States, a group of scientists and teachers are trying to get his works onto the national curriculum. And this is in part to honour what is the 71st anniversary of his death, falling on Orthodox Christmas Day.
So tell me, the Tesla car is actually named after him, is it?
It is, absolutely. And Tesla's a very, very big deal in Serbia, which is quite funny because although he was an ethnic Serb, he actually grew up in Croatia and went to university in Austria. And spent very little time in modern-day Serbia whatsoever. But the airport here is called Nikola Tesla Airport. There's Nikola Tesla Boulevard in New Belgrade. And your 100 dinar note has the same picture on it as you'll find on Nikola Tesla's Wikipedia page.
Amazing. And we'll move on. But we have to say goodbye, actually. But I did look it up. And it turns out that he was dapper dresser. He was very proud of the way he looked, and he kept the same weight throughout all of his adult life. Now, that's something you can't do after a Serbian Christmas, is it?
I love the way you brought that all back together, Andrew.
That was clever, wasn't it? And I've been working on that all day. Guy Delaunay in Belgrade, a pleasure as always to speak to you, and happy Christmas. I'm afraid I don't know how to say that in Serbian. Do you know how?
I know how to say srećna nova godina. Will that do?
Yeah, that'll do. Thank you very much. Well, up next, we're going to chat about a sky-high cycling proposal for London. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. With 14 cycling deaths in 2013, London is not the safest city to get around on two wheels. For those decrying the dangers of the capital's roads, meet SkyCycle, the revolutionary new proposal by the architecture firm Norman Foster. It's a network of elevated pathways above London's railways, and it's been called a cycling utopia. Hugh Thomas, partner at Foster & Partners, joins me now in the studio to explain how it could revolutionise the daily cycle. Hugh, thank you for coming. So we should just explain to people, I've seen these pictures. It looks at first glance like something out of a fantasy movie, but then you look at it and you realise it's almost realistic. So the idea is to use the existing rail network, isn't it, in yes. London, and to build cycle lanes above the train tracks?
Yes.
And how likely is this to happen? Is this one of these things that you create and you put out there to just start some debate? Or I know the Mayor of London is very keen on cycling. Is this something you'd be encouraged by Transport for London and by the Mayor's office to think about?
Well, I think we've come to it from the perspective of how do we view cities in the future as architects, as planners? How will cities cope with the growth that they're seeing, the demographic changes they're seeing? How will people move around and where are the new arteries for movement? And you pointed to the railways, they exist and people have built around them. They're part of the ecosystem of a city. So they're a natural place to look for those new movement opportunities. It's not about taking cyclists off the road. It's about giving new capacity for people to move around in and thinking about how cities could be different, what we might actually want 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Now, the very basic engineering of our cities obviously changes generation from generation. And in the 60s, you know, we obviously had the likes of Robert Moses thinking about cities as being built around the car and that's the means of transport in a way. And now we're thinking actually that people should walk more, and there's the Jan Gehl debate about, you know, making everywhere a little bit like Copenhagen, and we should get around by bicycles. So is it the mode of transport in the way that shapes the city, you know, our ambition for how people should get around, is that what in the end shapes the way our cities look and feel and how they work?
In part, but it's also how cities have developed as London is a very good example of villages growing together. And the connections between those villages are important. And what you find when you look at the railway network, the stations along the railways were the stations for villages in a large number of locations. So thinking about how the cities developed, thinking about local communities, how they connect, that's an important part of how London might develop going forwards. How do we get that capacity for people to connect and move under their own volition? We're investing very, very heavily in underground networks. We've been doing it for 150 years. Is in the same way there was that, I suppose at the time, breathtaking leap to think, well, we could travel underground. Is there today a way of thinking about, well, how could we travel above ground?
Now, you've put out some very interesting drawings and some very interesting proposals. Tell me, what is the life of this now then? Do you wait for somebody to seize on it and think about doing a pilot scheme? Or what do you hope happens next?
Well, we've been very heartened by the debate that has started, by the enthusiasm and encouragement we've received. And that was very much what we were trying to achieve. See, where did people think this could go? At the bigger picture level, start that debate and then hone in on what is the business case. Because it is a national scale project. It's the same as doing a Crossrail. So it's a city actually engaging with what is its future over the next 20 years? How will people move? How might investment be brought to look at projects like this? How might investment be brought to realise them?
So, now, retrofitting old cities and especially old Western cities can be a tough ask, because people always have, you know, you try and put, you know, a new bathroom on your house and you have like 50 people complaining. So the idea that we would build another level above rail lines, some people would have to make compromises about what they saw out the windows and how the structure of the city changed. Do you think it's a tough ask for an old city like London to adapt to this? But we've seen things like the High Line in New York and things, which again show what an elevated route can do for a city. Does that give you some hope?
Yeah. Railways in London, they tend to be the backyard. Things tend to decrease in value as they get closer to the railway. Railways are a block in the urban fabric. Putting something on top that isn't a railway, but is a route that people could walk, could jog, could cycle. It's a lightweight deck. Could include utilities. It could include new ways of delivering goods. But what it creates is effectively a new high street. It delivers a new level of value, a new level of movement. So what was traditionally, historically a back block has all of a sudden become a front block, could open up value. People have turned away from the railway. So as you go along the railway lines, you find very, very few occurrences where you would have a dramatic impact on property. The dramatic impact you're most likely to have is increasing value. So there is the whole engagement with how does the city react? How does a city develop, as Highline has shown? How does value unfold? Is it a place where you would put new school facilities, new health facilities? It's where people would like to live, adjacent to it, where they'd like to work? All those questions flow from it.
And I presume that the connectivity of rail and bicycle is also a very nice one, because I know in Japan and in Germany that they are trying to, you know, make sure that you can put your bike on a train and pop off at one station. So you could cycle, I presume you could come into train to one of the big kind of hub stations and then get your bicycle out and off you go into work.
Exactly.
Good. Well, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That was Hugh Thomas, who is a partner at Foster and Partners, telling us all about SkyCycle. Well, it's time for a short musical interlude now. We just heard about an elevated cycling plan, so let's stay on that track. Here's Joss Stone, who came into Midori House recently to give a live session with her cover of the Broken Bells song, The High Road. Well, that was Joss Stone with her cover of the Broken Bells song, The High Road. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we go, it's time for a cultural review. And joining me in the studio is Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International New York Times. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Andrew.
Very nice to see you.
Good to see you.
We're going to talk about the winners and losers recently over the holiday period and just before. And we're going to start with Candide. Now, this is in London, the Mernier Chocolate Factory. And this is a testing ground, isn't it, often, for musicals before they go into the West End?
That's right. The Mernier has a really extraordinary track record for a smallish venue of shows that transfer from the Meunier to the West End and often to Broadway. Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George, Sweet Charity, A Little Night Music. This is probably their most ambitious because it's a Leonard Bernstein musical that's been frequently revived and revised. It's got a very difficult, demanding score, and it's tricky, but they pull it off.
Well, let's just hear a tiny bit of that before we get your opinion whether they managed to pull it off.
Life is absolute perfection, as is true of my complexion. Every time I look and see me, I'm reminded life is dreamy. Although I do get tired being endlessly admired, people will go on about me. How could they go on without me? If the talk at times is vicious, that's...
So, Matt, do they manage to pull it off?
I think they do, Andrew. I really do. I have to say that it took me 3 goes before I was actually able to see this production. The first 2 times I was scheduled to see it, the performances didn't happen. And I think there is a certain amount of vocal wear and tear that takes place. The performance I finally saw the other night was pitch perfect. And one of the things about such a small venue is that the cast gives it their all. There's no marking it. There's no hiding. So when they're singing a Leonard Bernstein operetta that's 3 hours long, 8 times a week, there are going to be, you know, some glitches along the way.
Now, I understand that part of the reason, you know, is it's been done by lots of different people, and it's not always been done successfully, as you say. Now, I was just looking at what it's based on. It says it's based on Voltaire's satirical philosophical novella of 1759. That doesn't sound like a winner. How do you turn that into a kind of toe-tapping success?
Well, toe-tapping is possibly not the adjective that one would apply to this.
That's why you're a theatre critic. I'm not, you see.
This is a show that you could do in the concert hall, you could do in the opera house, or you could do it in a pub. There are all sorts of scaled versions of it. This is a larky, knockabout, smaller-scale version, which plays down the pretensions implicit in your description. Yes, it does have this 18th-century Enlightenment-era source. It can also be a hell of a lot of fun. The gist of it is basically disproving the notion that we live in the best of all possible worlds. And what our innocent, wide-eyed young hero, Candide, has to do is discover that actually life is full of grit and grimness and then grace.
Well, let's jump over to New York now, where on Broadway, Sir Patrick Stewart and Sir Ian McKellen have been doing 2 plays back-to-back. They're doing Waiting for Godot and No Man's Land. I hadn't seen that Pinter play, and I was in New York recently, and I went to see No Man's Land, and actually I saw them both back to back, and actually I think I enjoyed No Man's Land even more. I'd never seen the play. It's a bit like Waiting for Godot, though, isn't it? There's a bit of a, you don't know who's called, what's really going on. And
yeah.
you can't really want to know the outcome too much. If you just have to kind of give yourself up to it a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, one is by Pinter, one is by Beckett, and Pinter was steeped in Beckett. So it makes a lot of sense that they're paired. They also both call for a cast of four. So they twin very well. It's actually, No Man's Land is the first play I ever saw in London, probably before you were born, when I was a teenager, with Ralph Richardson and John Gielgud. So I have very fond memories of it. This production, I think, is extremely good. I'm surprised it's on Broadway, because it's kind of tough fare for your kind of tired Saturday night Broadway playgoer, but it has two actor nights for the price of one, and it's extremely well done, particularly McKellen in the part originated by John Gielgud, this kind of raffish, seedy poet who looks like he's kind of falling to bits, but the one thing that he still has is language.
And the funny thing is that there's quite a lot of comedy in it as well. I guess like Waiting for Godot, you're surprised at the humour in these very dark, menacing characters often.
Yeah, I mean, it's a play, I think, about our approach towards death, which is referenced by the No Man's Land of the title. And it's got this rather extraordinarily bleak ending, which sounds like it could have been written by T.S. Eliot. But along the way, there's a lot of vaudevillian banter. There's a lot of sheer linguistic sort of larkiness. And these two, because they're such prose, they make what could be heavy seem very light. And I think that's the achievement.
And it's amazing to see what theatre, neither gentleman is spring chicken, but the physicality of both those plays, and especially and also in No Man's Land, they throw themselves around, they're falling on the floor. They're two fit older gentlemen.
Well, Patrick Stewart makes sort of a fetish of his fitness if you read or look up anything about him. I mean, he's 70, whatever, with the body of a 20-something-year-old. But there is a famous moment in No Man's Land where his character has to fall to the floor. Harold Pinter himself played the part in a London revival at one point. And you feel Patrick Stewart really relishing that because he can do it with a sort of Sylvester Stallone-like aplomb.
Now, I'll have one final check-in for today. And this is Ethan Hawke and Anne-Marie Duff in a staging of Macbeth. Now, do they get away with it?
This presumably wasn't on your must-see list, was it,
no,
in New York?
Right.
He certainly doesn't. She sort of does. She would in a better production. Her husband, James McAvoy, played Macbeth in London last year very well, and she must be looking at Ethan Hawke going, why didn't you just do what James did? He wants to be a serious classical actor, but he can't really cut it, and the result is that he either bellows his lines or whispers them, and neither one really works.
Okay, well, we know what we're to see after speaking to Matt. Thank you very much for coming to see us. That was Matt Wolfe, who's the London theatre critic for the International New York Times. And, well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Robert Fox and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanich and Haley Joely Ott, and also our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next, after the headlines, is Culture with Robert Bound. Here's a little taste of what's to come.
The drama that I referred to last year was Maison Close, which is this very opulent drama set in a Parisian brothel. That's back for a second series. And HBO were so impressed with the show that they are developing an English language remake.
Well, then 2200 Hours is the Monocle Daily. Our morning show will be back tomorrow. But that's all for now from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you for listening.